if you call using a high-pitched tone of voice. You're tuned in to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Finally, we have an article by Leanne Itali from the Hartford Courant, and it's titled, Pets and the City. As a city kid, Amy Attis had big dreams of roaming the countryside, healing animals, a la James Herriot's classic book, All Creatures Great and Small. How did it go? Well, the veterinarian made it from Queens to Manhattan in New York City, spending the last 32 years traversing the streets of her hometown as a full-time house call doc. And boy, does she have stories to tell, from escaping a massive, ailing, and territory-threatened Rottweiler, fangs fully bared, to 3 weeks on intravenous antibiotics after a nasty bite from a cat patient. Then there are the humans behaving badly. No dog of mine will be neutered. And the pampered celebrity-owned pets, including the beloved dogs of the late Joan Rivers, whom Attis counted as a friend. Cher once bared all to show Attis a rash after she adopted a dog with mange, and Billy Joel serenaded her on the piano. You'll never guess what happened today, was Attis' nightly refrain to her husband. Now she's collected these tales into a juicy and compassionate memoir called Pets and the City. Woven among her stories are tips and advice for animal lovers. The pug-loving Dr. Attis had no grand business plans for her city pets practice when she first packed up supplies and began traveling by subway and taxi. She had just left a Tony Upper East Side animal hospital, and some of her clients, including Joan Rivers, wanted to keep using her. She assumed the house calls would be temporary. When it started, it was a novelty, said Attis. From day one, I was busy. She has more company now, as concierge services in general have grown in popularity. Other vets around the country do it full-time like Dr. Attis, while some maintain brick-and-mortar practices and provide home services for end-of-life care. Attis, meanwhile, has graduated to a private car and driver. She starts her day at 8 in the morning, accompanied by one or both of her nurses. I initially thought my practice would be filled with people who had difficulty getting to the vet, and maybe older people who had pets, or people with physical disabilities, she said. Well, they do seek her out, but, Attis said, what I didn't realize was how attractive it would be to all kinds of other pet owners. For example, meet Putty, the beloved 19-year-old domestic short-haired cat of artist Wendy Beyer. The arthritic black-and-white cat has high blood pressure and requires monthly checkups. Beyer found Dr. Attis through an online search. It's life-saving, said Beyer of having Putty cared for in the comfort of his own home, a cozy sun and art-filled apartment in the Hudson Yards neighborhood near 34th Street. He's never liked being in a carrier. It's so traumatic trying to get him in the carrier myself. Beyer also likes Attis's no-pressure approach to her decision to let Putty age naturally without heroic measures. I think it's helping to extend his life. He's really a relaxed, chill kitty. He's not being stressed out, said Beyer. Now hop on over to Fifth Avenue for a check on Cody, an adorable, barky white Maltese who, at age 8, is a bundle of fun-loving energy. He's at the center of Lisa Healy's life. Cody has itchy allergies and a heart murmur. Attis, who helped the Healys bid farewell to a previous dog, regularly sees Cody in the couple's apartment. This is our child, and we would do anything for our children, so it's worth the cost. It's worth every penny. I don't even think about it, said Healy. So far, Dr. Attis has seen more than 7,000 animals in her travels, including the pets of Billy Joel, Wayne Gretzky, Steve Martin, and Kevin Klein. At minimum, she or one of the other two vets in her practice visit 12 to 15 homes every day. Her personal best in terms of animals seen in a day is 23. Dr. Attis dispels the notion that her client list is solely filled with pets of the wealthy. "I go to billionaires' homes," she says. "I go to housing projects. I work with nonprofits to help seniors continue to live with their pets," she says. "Some of my favorite clients through the years were people who didn't really have a lot, but what they cherished most were their pets." Addis never wants to be so busy that she loses the intimate value of home visits. "When you're in the home, you're experiencing how that pet lives," she says. "I can't even think of how many times I've been in someone's home where I see something that is a complete danger for a pet. That includes potential killers like open windows with no screens, toxic plants, and unsecured terraces." She ended one owner's practice of serving up massive quantities of catnip after the cat went seriously loopy. And she found an unlikely object inside a bull terrier: his human's giant over-ear headphones. The human wondered where they'd gone. "We couldn't figure out how he even consumed them," said Addis. She keeps a keen eye on humans who sometimes need help themselves. "I've seen seniors who have lost pets and lose their will to live. In one particular case that I talk about in the book, a lovely woman's elderly dog passed away, and when I went to check on her a week later, she was a fraction of the woman I had seen the week before," said Addis. So Addis brought the grieving 90-year-old client a senior dog to adopt under the guise of fostering. "She immediately had a reason to live again," said Addis, "and took care of that dog until the day she passed away." And that'll do it for this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the Hartford Courant, the PetRadar.com website, the Connecticut Humane Society website, and the DogTime.com website. I'm Mario Cajar. So long till next time.
You're listening to Chris Radio, Connecticut's talking newsstand. It's 8:30.
Chris Sports. Chris takes a look now at the sports sections of today's newspapers. The sports data. Sports stats you get only from the newspaper. Now, Chris Sports.
Hello, everybody. Today is Friday, July 12th, and this is Bill Murphy with Chris Sports, and we'll do baseball. We'll start with the scores. First, I'll give you the Red Sox score. They won yesterday. They shut out the Athletics 7-0. The Rays beat the Yankees 5-4 down in Tampa Bay, and the Nationals lost to the Mets, and that score was also 7-0. And I have a story on that because that was a day game. The Mets are officially in playoff position with their 7-0 win over the Washington Nationals at Citi Field on Thursday afternoon. The Mets moved into a virtual tie with and percentage points ahead of the San Diego Padres for the third and final National League wildcard spot. Brandon Nimmo's three-run double against Washington starter Mackenzie Gore broke a scoreless tie in the fifth inning and served as the big blow in a five-run frame. That was more than enough run support for Mets starter David Peterson, who hurled six scoreless innings to help finish off a three-game sweep of the Nationals. The Mets' 47-45 record gives them a 5.11 winning percentage just ahead of San Diego's 5.10 mark at 49-47. The Padres, who are off Thursday, have lost four games in a row. The more that we can get cushion and the more that we can stay in that, the more that it incentivizes our staying in this thing and being buyers at the trade deadline. Nimmo said, "The work is not done, no doubt. We've put in a lot of work to get back to this point because we dug ourselves a bit of a hole. But we believe we're a good team. We don't believe this is just a fluke." It's the first time since May 9th that the Mets have held a share of a playoff spot. At that point, the Mets, Padres, and Nationals were each at 500. It's also the first time since April 24th that the Mets are at least two games above 500. Indeed, a roller coaster season, which the Mets began 0-5 and fell a season worse, 11 games below 500 on May 29th, is trending upward. How far back we got to be able to get to this position is a good feeling, but also understanding that we've got a long ways to go, manager Carlos Mendoza said. Early in Thursday's outing, Peterson appeared to be in for a long afternoon. He allowed four of the Nationals' first seven hitters to reach base and made a throwing error on a first-inning pickoff attempt. Back-to-back hits to begin the second inning put runners on the corners with no outs. But Peterson dialed in. He extinguished that second-inning scoring threat with three consecutive strikeouts, freezing first-time All-Star C.J. Abrams with a 3-2 sinker for the third out. Peterson cruised from there, holding Washington to one hit over his final four frames. The left-hander finished with five strikeouts against four hits and three walks and exited to a standing ovation. The Mets can breathe a sigh of relief about reliever Reed Garrett's ailing right elbow. An MRI revealed inflammation of the nerve, manager Carlos Mendoza said Thursday in an update he described as, quote, good news, end quote. Garrett is expected to be out between 2 and 4 weeks, Mendoza said. I was concerned, Mendoza said after Thursday's 7-0 win over the Washington Nationals at Citi Field. Huge relief. The next step in Kodai Senga's shoulder rehab has been decided. The Mets ace is set to make his third minor league rehab start on Sunday at AAA Syracuse. Manager Carlos Mendoza confirmed on Thursday. Senga is expected to throw 60 to 65 pitches and potentially go four innings against Scranton Wilkes-Barre as he continues to work his way back from the right shoulder strain that's kept him out since spring training. The start is set to come on 4 days' rest. Now over to the Red Sox, Alex Cora isn't afraid to give his best players a day off if he thinks it will help keep them fresh. He used to do it for Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts during their time with the Red Sox, and whenever he did, he'd always say he was trying to take care of them. But this season, he's taking a different approach with Jarren Duran, who has played in every one of Boston's first 91 games this season. Asked what makes the dynamic leadoff hitter different, Cora playfully teased his former stars. Because he's tougher than those guys, Cora said with a laugh. Cora went on to explain that Duran has proven he can maintain a heavy workload physically and that he's become an indispensable fixture right up there in importance with Rafael Devers. Put simply, the Red Sox need him in the lineup and Cora is comfortable writing his name in every day. We just felt like he can handle it, Cora said. He's accepted the challenge. We're going to keep playing him. He's one of our best players. Duran has lived up to his end of the bargain, earning his first career All-Star honor after ranking among the American League tops all-around players through the first half. He currently ranks among the league's leaders in hits. He has 107, doubles 25, triples 10, extra base hits 45, stolen bases 22, and runs scored 60. And he's also regarded as one of the league's best defensive outfielders and base runners. Let's see if we have any more. I guess we're going to go right to the Yankees. And we have a story on the Yankees. They lost yesterday 5-4 down in St. Pete. The Yankees, Aaron Boone, said the other day what he always says. When his team falls down again, the words have become as inevitable as the tide. Boone said, it's all right there in front of us. But guess what? This time he was absolutely right. It is all in front of Boone's Yankees. The rest of the season starts now with three against the Orioles in Baltimore, followed by the All-Star break, followed by the schedule after the break that takes them into the first week of August. Four against the Rays at the stadium, two at the stadium against the Mets, 3 against the Red Sox at Fenway, 3 on the road against the Phillies, 3 at home against the Blue Jays. The Yankees clearly aren't as good as they were when they were the first team in baseball to 50 wins, when they were playing better ball than anybody. And they can't possibly be as bad as the 6-16 team that they have been since they did get to 50. But what we are going to find out starting in Baltimore is whether or not the Yankee team, this team, is different from all the ones who haven't been good enough to make the World Series since 2009. They are going to get this season turned around over the next month or so, or they are going to get their manager fired, whatever Brian Cashman is saying about that at the moment. Cashman went all in this time, did he ever, by making the trade for Juan Soto, even knowing he might only have Soto for one season. And when the Yankees were going as good as they were in April and May and into the middle of June, really going great guns, Soto looked like he was exactly what they brought him here to be. The same thing Reggie Jackson was brought here to be merely a half century ago, which means the straw that stirs the drink. But since they did have the best record, and especially since that weekend in Fenway, when the Red Sox turned their season around and did the same for the Yankees, you have seen them fall down again. You've seen them go down the way they did 2 years ago, when after they started 64-28 and were supposed to be on their way back to the Canyon of Heroes, they became a 500 team the rest of the way, 35 wins and 35 losses. In the early innings of this season, they had the best starting pitching anywhere, even without Gerrit Cole. They had Aaron Judge and Soto looking like the most devastating 1-2 punch in a Yankee batting order since Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle in 1961. Only then came, well, this. By now, Yankee fans know dreary months like this the way they know the passcode on their phones. That's why they have a right to ask this question about the current edition of the Yankees, the latest one assembled by the permanent government at Yankee Stadium, a question their fans will keep asking until the Yankees are once again the best team in baseball. If not now, when? Can the Yankees get themselves squared away, even if the Orioles keep them on their smack list this weekend? Of course they can. If the narrative can change in a month the way it just did, the wrong way, it can turn right back around. Cole can start pitching the way we expect him to. Carlos Rodon can start to pitch like he's not just another high-profile Yankee pitching hire who can't perform to his former level in the big bad city. Giancarlo Stanton might come back from yet another visit to the IL and perform the way he was before he once again couldn't make it around the bases. And the kid at shortstop, Anthony Volpe, might once again start looking like the player the Yankees so desperately wanted to be, instead of someone who, during this streak of truly pathetic baseball, has watched his batting average drop at the same time his on-base percentage has been dropping like a rock. So the Yankees need to make a stand, maybe as soon as this weekend. This hasn't just been a bad month for them, it's truly been the worst month imaginable, because not only have they fallen down the way they have watched these three teams all rise up at the same time, Red Sox, Astros, and Mets. They still have the traditional second half of the season to play. Yeah, the manager is right. It's all right there in front of them. The last time he said that, he slapped the table. But if his team doesn't turn things around this time, it might be somebody else's table before too long. And I want to go back to the Red Sox. There was another story that I neglected to read. This isn't how Vaughn Grissom envisioned his first season with the Red Sox going. Acquired this past winter in exchange for Chris Sale, the 23-year-old infielder was expected to seize Boston's starting second base job and establish himself as one of the organization's top young players. Instead, Grissom got hurt almost immediately and has suffered one setback after another ever since. Now Grissom is slowly building back up and hopes he can still make a difference down the stretch. It's one of those things where you have to play it safe, Grissom said of his rehab process. It's not as fun, it's not the scenic route, but it is what it is. Grissom is currently on the 10-day injury list with a right hamstring strain, an injury he suffered in part because he was trying to compensate for an earlier left hamstring strain. That injury cost him nearly all of spring training, and right before he was meant to be activated in late April, Grissom came down with the flu, which caused him to drop 14 pounds and delayed his activation by nearly a week. Once he finally got on the field, he clearly wasn't the same. In 23 games before going back on the IL with his current hamstring strain, Grissom batted 148 with no home runs and 3 RBIs. He only managed one extra base hit in 87 plate appearances and was among the worst offensive performers in the league in that stretch. At first, I felt like I was hitting the ball pretty well, but I wasn't getting any luck. And then you're not getting any luck, so you try to force things, and your swing changes, and you don't even know it, Grissom said. Now you're digging yourself into a hole, and it's like, okay, now I've got to get out of that hole and get back to where you were. And then you're not getting luck again. So it's like a constant thing. The irony of Grissom's situation is that Sale, who'd battled his own injury issues for nearly 5 straight years, is enjoying a career renaissance in Atlanta and recently earned his first All-Star nod since 2018. The good news is the Red Sox have exceeded expectations without either of them, and manager Alex Cora said they're willing to be patient if that's what it takes to get the best version of Grissom back on the field. He hasn't been healthy the whole time, Cora said, so the most important thing for us right now is to get him as healthy as possible so he can become the player everyone envisioned. Since he went back on the IL in early June, the club has taken care to make sure Grissom is fully healthy and built up before attempting to get him back in game action. And that's been a lot of repetitive workouts and activities, but Wednesday, Cora suggested they could start discussing a rehab assignment by week's end, signaling a possible light at the end of the tunnel. We're going to go to the weather. I'll be back with more sports after that.
If you have the Amazon Echo or Google Home, you can listen to Chris on TuneIn.
There's a flood watch in effect from today, Saturday, July 13th, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can expect showers today and possibly a thunderstorm. Some of the storms could produce heavy rainfall, high near 85. Partly cloudy this evening with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, low around 69. Sunny day on Sunday with a high near 92. Mostly clear Sunday evening with a low around 70. Monday looks to be mostly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, high near 95. Partly cloudy Monday evening with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, low around 71. And Tuesday, mostly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, high near 96. Partly cloudy Tuesday evening with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, low around 72. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening to Chris.
One more baseball note concerning the All-Star game. Marcus Semien of the host Rangers will replace the Astros' Jose Altuve as the AL's starting second baseman for the All-Star game. Altuve will rest his left hand, which has been sore since he was hit by a 94.3-mile-per-hour slider from the Twins' Josh Winder on July 5th. Twins infielder and outfielder Willy Castro replaces Altuve on the AL roster, and Orioles outfielder Anthony Santander took the spot of the Astros' Kyle Tucker out since June 3rd because of a bruised right shin. Castro and Santander increased the total of their first All-Stars to 36. And one more note from the Cubs. The Cubs have placed outfielder Cody Bellinger on the 10-day IL with a left middle finger fracture. Bellinger was hit by a pitch thrown by Sinel Perez in the seventh inning of Wednesday night's 4-0 victory over the Orioles. And we have a story here on the Celtics. Celtics fans will get their first look at Boston's two 2024 draft picks when the Las Vegas Summer League tips off this weekend. First-round pick Baylor Shireman and second-rounder Anton Watson headline the Celtics Summer League roster, which was announced on Monday. Shireman, the first round one pick of the Brad Stevens era, signed his rookie contract over the weekend. He and Watson both had five-year college careers and will turn 24 before the 2024-25 season begins, meaning they should be more pro-ready than some of Boston's other recent draftees. Speaking of prior second-rounders, Jordan Walsh, 2023, and J.D. Davison, 2022, also will take part in a summer league after spending most of last season with the Celtics G League affiliate in Maine. Boston's roster for Vegas features a total of five players who were with the team during its NBA championship run. Forwards Walsh and Drew Peterson, guards Davison and Jalen Springer, and center Nemias Kleta. Walsh, Kleta, and Springer were active for all of Boston's postseason games, but played only in garbage time. Davison and Peterson did not dress for any playoff contests after making a total of 11 appearances for the big club during the regular season. Rounding out the roster were forwards Tyler Cook, Tristan Anaruna, and Ron Harper Jr., guards Jalen House and Jamias Ramsey, and center Killian Tilly. The well-traveled Cook has appeared in games for Cleveland, Denver, Brooklyn, Detroit, and Chicago, and most recently played for Joventut Badalona in Spain's Liga ACB. Anaruna is an undrafted rookie who averaged 19.6 points per game at Cleveland State last season after stints at Kansas and Iowa State. Harper, whose father won five NBA titles as a player, appeared in 10 games for Toronto over the last two seasons after going undrafted out of Rutgers. House's father, Eddie, was part of Boston's 2008 championship team and now works as a Celtics analyst for NBC Sports Boston. The younger House went undrafted this year out of New Mexico. Ramsey has bounced between the NBA and G League since being drafted in the second round by Sacramento in 2020. Tilly has 54 games of NBA experience, but none since 2022. The 26-year-old freshman overlapped with Watson for one season at Gonzaga. The Celtics Summer League squad will be coached by DJ McLea, who's entering his third season as an assistant coach under Joe Mazzulla. The Young Seas will open their Summer League slate this Saturday at 6:30 p.m. against the Miami Heat. The matchup likely to draw the most eyeballs is their second Monday at 10:30 p.m. against Bronny James and the Los Angeles Lakers. Boston then will face the Charlotte Hornets Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. and Dallas Mavericks July 19th, 4:30 p.m. before playing either a playoff or consolation game the following weekend. All games will air locally on NBC Sports Boston and nationally on NBA TV. Heat, Lakers, Hornets, or ESPNU Mavs. And let's tell you what's going on with Wimbledon. Jasmine Paolini kept coming back against Donna Vekic in what would become the longest Wimbledon women's semifinal on record after dropping the opening set after being two games from defeat in each of the last two sets after twice trailing by a break in the third. And all the while, this is what Paolini kept telling herself Thursday: try point by point and fight for every ball. Paolini never had won a match at the All England Club until last week and now will participate in her second consecutive Grand Slam final thanks to a rollicking 2-6, 6-4, 7-6, 10-8 victory over the unseeded Vekic across 2 hours 51 minutes on center court. This match, said the number 7 Paolini, who now faces number 31 Barbara Krejcikova for the title, I will remember forever, as will many of the thousands who were present or the millions watching on TV. It was, Paolini said, a roller coaster of emotions. The same could be said of the second semifinal, which lasted 44 fewer minutes, but contained its own share of plot twists as 2021 French Open champion Krejcikova came back to eliminate 2022 Wimbledon champion Elena Rybakina, 3-6, 6-3, 6-4. Whoever wins on Saturday will be the eighth woman to leave the all-England club with the title in the past eight editions of the tournament. Krejcikova trailed 4-0 at the start, reeled off four of five games to take the second set, then earned the pivotal break to move ahead 5-3 in the third against Rybakina, who entered the day with a 19-2 career mark at the All England Club. During the second set, somewhere in the middle, I was getting my momentum, Krejcikova said, but when I broke her, I started to be in the zone, and I didn't want to leave the zone. Still, I couldn't approach the drama produced by Paolini and Vekic. Consider Vekic making her debut in a slam semifinal, ending up claiming more points, 118 to 111, delivering more winners, 42-26, and breaking serve more often, 4-3. She was hitting winners everywhere, Paolini said. But Paolini never went away, eventually converting her third match point when Vekic sent a forehand wide. This showing in the grass courts at Wimbledon follows Paolini's runner-up finish to Iga Swiatek on the red clay at the French Open last month. Paolini, a 28-year-old from Italy, is the first woman to get to the title matches at Roland Garros and the All England Club in the same season since Serena Williams did it in 2016. I want to stop there and just do the men. Carlos Alcaraz's ability to hit any type of shot from any position on the court, on any surface, keeps fans on the edge of their seats, keeps other players guessing too. Alcaraz delights in all of that. He loves putting on a show just as much as he enjoys knowing he makes the guys on the other side of the net uncomfortable, and figures it can only help him in the Wimbledon semifinals against Daniil Medvedev on Friday. It's beneficial, Alcaraz said, that opponents need to focus on whether he'll be able to be back in the point or able to hit an unbelievable shot. For me, he said, it's great that they're thinking about it. Alcaraz, the number three seed, is seeking a second consecutive trophy at the All England Club and the fourth Grand Slam title overall. His triumph last month at the French Open made him, at 21, the youngest man to collect a major trophy on hard grass and clay courts. Medvedev, who is seeded number five and defeated number one Jannik Sinner in the quarterfinals, won the 2021 U.S. Open, but is just 1-5 in major finals. The other match Friday will be number two Novak Djokovic, who has won seven of his men's record 24 slam championships at Wimbledon, against number 25 Lorenzo Musetti, making his debut in a major semifinal. Against him, you are probably more stressed because he's probably the best player ever, or one of the best players ever, said the 22-year-old Musetti, who beat Taylor Fritz in five sets on Wednesday, while Djokovic got the day off because his foe, Alex de Minaur, withdrew with an injured hip. You walk on the court with a different mentality, said Musetti, whose 1-5 record against Djokovic includes a five-set loss at this year's French Open that ended out after 3 a.m. If I play in a certain way, I could have my shot in the next round. Alcaraz versus Medvedev is a rematch from last year's semifinals when Alcaraz won in straight sets before getting past Djokovic in the final. It also offers a contrast between a talented attacker, Alcaraz, and a consummate defender, Medvedev. The most difficult thing about facing Daniil, or the most special thing about him, is he can reach every ball. Well, he's like a wall. Every ball bounces back. Asked what Alcaraz's best quality is, Medvedev began this way, to be honest, everything. That sounds like an exaggeration. It might not be. That's where it's tough to play against him because, you know, whatever shot you hit, he can hit a winner from there. So you try to make his life difficult. You try to hit the shot as good as you can. Maybe he goes for it and not make it. Said Medvedev, who has won just two of their previous six encounters. Carlos can do whatever from any position, Medvedev said, and that's not easy to play against. So that's all for the sports for today. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend, everybody, and please stay safe.
Our first article is titled Last Holdout Leaving Failing Plaza from the Sunday CT section of the Sunday, July 7th, Hartford Courant. Peruvian restaurant agrees to vacate Silver Lane, paving the way for a major redevelopment project. This is by Don Stakem from the Hartford Courant. After a sports bar and two tiny restaurants in the doomed Silver Lane Plaza recently agreed to move out, East Hartford last week negotiated a deal for the last tenant, Toby's Peruvian Cuisine, to leave. With the main section of the long, blighted Silver Lane Plaza recently demolished, the town is eager to tear down both smaller side buildings and push forward its plan for an ambitious redevelopment. With the Toby's agreement in place, East Hartford anticipates the final business will be gone by the end of September. The town has to have Toby's Malibu Sports Bar and Lounge, Faux House, and Lucky China out before it can bring in demolition crews. Redeveloping the property into a mix of modern housing and retail is essential to revitalize the Silver Lane corridor, officials say. When the town acquired the 22-acre retail plaza in March 2023, it hoped for a quick relocation of about a dozen small businesses that were still operating in the mostly vacant and badly run-down complex. East Hartford had taken the title to the property for $4.5 million in an eminent domain action against Leon Chen's East Hartford Venture LLC. Several of the small merchants balked at the prospect of relocating, however. Town officials said they were paying far below market value rents because of the poor condition of the property and mostly had month-to-month leases that ended after the town bought the property. A few of the larger businesses accepted town aid to relocate. The J Market Grocery moved to Manchester, while Tooth Time Dentistry reopened in Hartford. Bare Bones Boxing ended up in a nearby holding on Silver Lane that its owner found far preferable to the old plaza. Several businesses have complained that the town wasn't offering enough to compensate them for leaving. Xingting Yang, owner of Lucky China, told a judge that the town offered him $20,000, but he claimed it would cost $200,000 to relocate his tiny storefront Chinese restaurant to Torrington. The town succeeded in clearing all tenants out of the main building and recently finished demolishing it. As many of you have probably noticed, the center building is now completely down. The lot itself is graded and hydro-seeded, Mayor Connor Martin told the town council on June 18th. We are doing some hazardous waste abatement studies on the two side buildings. The town began eviction cases last year against businesses that wouldn't leave the two smaller buildings alongside the main plaza, and last month reached settlements with three of the last four holdouts. Lucky China, Faux House, and Malibu Sports Bar and Lounge agreed to leave by the end of August. But Toby's contended that it had invested heavily in decor and fixtures at its restaurant and continued contesting the eviction. Unlike other Silver Lane Plaza buildings, it paid for new tile flooring, modern wall fixtures, and relatively upscale furniture. The town and Toby's were scheduled for a court-supervised mediation on Tuesday. By the end of the day, they had agreed to a deal that lets the restaurant. Neither the manager nor owner were at the restaurant during visits last week. Herman Todd, one of the first commercial tenants to leave, said Monday that he sympathizes with Toby's. Todd moved his Living World Imprints company from the plaza to a newer building across Silver Lane last year and has said the town didn't make good on promises to fairly compensate him. The town agreed to reimburse up to $40,000 or so of costs we incurred. Most costs were $33,000. They offered me $12,000, Todd said. One contractor who put in carpeting and built a changing room charged $12,000. They finally paid $20,000, but that's less than the cost to move. And I know Toby's put in a lot, but they didn't have enough time to make their money back. Toby's has already opened Toby's 2 in Winstead, and there are reports that it plans to move the East Hartford business to a location just over the Glastonbury line. Grossman Development Group is negotiating details with the town about its plan for redeveloping the entire 22-acre plaza site once the two remaining buildings are leveled. That would be a major accomplishment for East Hartford, which had been frustrated for decades as the plaza fell into disrepair and partial vacancy. Its parking lot is a rubble-strewn maze of potholes and cracked pavement, and consultants have said a larger-scale refresh of the entire Silver Lane corridor would need a solution to the blight of the plaza. Next up from the Sunday CT section, we have four quick crime-related stories, all written by a staff reporter. Man allegedly threatened to shoot mall security officer, store worker. A man accused of threatening to shoot a Connecticut mall security officer, store employee, on Wednesday was arrested after a police standoff. Officers responded to the Connecticut Post Mall in Milford on Wednesday at 5 p.m. for a report of a threatening complaint, according to the Milford Police Department. As officers were en route to the mall, they received information that a man threatened mall security with a firearm and fled into the wooded area behind 1250 Boston Post Road, police said. The man's description was relayed to officers. Afterward, an officer spotted the man who fled into a garage on Cedar Hill Road, according to police. The man yelled to officers that he had a hostage in the garage, which later turned out to be false, police said. After a short time, the man identified as 36-year-old Jamar Jarrett of Bridgeport complied with the officer's commands, exited the garage. Police said they did not locate a firearm. During the investigation, officers learned that a mall security officer had been contacted to respond to the American Eagle store for a shoplifting complaint. According to police, when the security officer arrived at the store, an employee pointed out the shoplifter in another store. As they attempted to stop Jarrett, he began to run. Jarrett told the security officer and the store employee that he was going to shoot them, and they claimed that they observed him reaching toward the front area of his waistband as if he had a concealed firearm in his pants, police said. Jarrett was positively identified by the security officer, according to police. He was found in possession of stolen items from three stores in the mall, including American Eagle, police said. The stolen merchandise from American Eagle was reportedly valued at $239.80, according to police. Jarrett was arrested and charged with two counts of first-degree robbery, sixth-degree larceny, threatening, second-degree breach of peace, and interfering with an officer. Police said Jarrett also had an active arrest warrant from the Milford Police Department for a shoplifting incident that occurred on May 14th at Macy's. The warrant was subsequently served for the charge of fourth-degree larceny. Jarrett also had an active remand-to-custody order from the Department of Parole and was turned over to the Connecticut Department of Correction. He is scheduled to appear in Milford Superior Court on July 31st for the above cases, according to police. Teen arrested after Southington car theft. Two juveniles are facing burglary charges after allegedly breaking into multiple motor vehicles in Southington on Friday. Patrol officers were dispatched to the area of Lanning Street around 5:21 a.m. on Friday on a report of active motor vehicle burglaries, according to Southington Police Department. As officers canvassed the area of the Days Inn on 30 Lanning Street and Kenmore Apartments at 78 Lanning Street, an officer reported hearing voices coming from 48 Lanning Street, where he observed two males committing motor vehicle burglaries, police said. As the officer announced himself, both males attempted to flee on foot, running westbound toward Interstate 84. Officers gave chase and were able to quickly apprehend one of the males. A perimeter was set up, and officers were able to locate the second male, who was hiding in a wooded area, police said. Police allege that four motor vehicles in the area had either been entered or attempted to have been entered by the two males. One of these vehicles had a side window smashed out, according to police. As a result of the initial investigation, both males, juveniles aged 16 and 17, were placed under arrest. Juvenile number one was charged with two counts of third-degree criminal attempt to commit burglary, two counts of third-degree burglary, and interfering with an officer. Juvenile number two was allegedly found in possession of a screwdriver that police believed may have been used to attempt to gain entry into vehicles, according to police. He was charged with two counts of third-degree criminal attempt to commit burglary, two counts of third-degree burglary, interfering with an officer, and possession of burglar tools. Both juveniles were released to their respective guardians, police said. According to police, juvenile number one was issued a juvenile summons and is set to appear at juvenile court in Waterbury on July 11th. Juvenile number two was issued a juvenile summons and is set to appear at juvenile court in New Haven on July 11th. Thompson man tracked by police dog found hiding behind washing machine. A Thompson man with an active arrest warrant was found by police after he allegedly broke into a house and hid behind a washing machine, state police said. Christopher Sargent, 36, faces several charges, including an outstanding warrant out of Putnam. Troopers with Troop D out of Danielson said they were called to an address on Brady Hill Road in Thompson around 11:40 a.m. on Thursday for a man wandering through several backyards. It was additionally reported the man had run from neighbors in the area and possibly entered a home through a basement window. Troopers said they used their canine boss to track Sargent, conducted a building search, and police allege he was found hiding in a small room and behind a washing machine in the basement of the home. Police gave verbal commands and he came out with his hands up. Police also allege that Sargent had cocaine on him when they searched him. Sargent is charged with third-degree burglary and possession of a controlled substance, police said. Further, Sargent had an active arrest warrant from a separate incident with several charges, including first-degree criminal trespass, sixth-degree larceny, and second-degree breach of peace. State police said he was released from custody on a $7,500 bond and is scheduled to appear in Danielson Superior Court on July 18th. Smoke shop targeted in smash-and-grab burglary. Police are looking for three suspects in a smash-and-grab burglary at a smoke shop in Wallingford on Friday. Officers responded to Smoke Rules located at 200 Church Street around 3:31 a.m. on Friday for a burglar alarm, according to the Wallingford Police Department. As officers arrived, they noted that the front door was smashed and shattered glass was on the ground, police said. The officers reviewed surveillance video and observed three suspects wearing black hooded sweatshirts and masks smash the front door and enter at 3:20 a.m., according to police. One of the suspects, who police said was wearing gloves, jumped over the counter and took $800 from a cash register drawer, as the other two suspects, who were not wearing gloves, guarded the front door, police said. According to police, the three suspects exited Smoke Rules through the shattered front door a minute later and fled the scene before officers arrived. The suspects remain at large, police said. Anyone with information about the incident is asked to contact Wallingford Police at 203-294-2800 or on the web at police.wallingfordct.gov. Continuing in the Sunday CT section, election complaint may bring charges. SEEC refers another Bridgeport ballot case to state prosecutors. This is by Andrew Brown and Dave Altamari from the CT Mirror. Bridgeport City Councilwoman Maria Perea could potentially face criminal charges for allegedly mishandling voters' absentee ballots during the city's Democratic primary last year. The State Elections Enforcement Commission, which is responsible for investigating violations of the state's election laws, voted on Wednesday to forward the complaint filed against Pereira to the Chief State's Attorney's Office for potential criminal prosecution. That referral marks the third case the SEEC has handed over to state prosecutors in the aftermath of Bridgeport's 2023 Democratic primary, which was marred by widespread allegations of ballot harvesting and resulted in a state Superior Court judge tossing the results of the city's mayoral contest. During that election, Pereira was running to maintain her seat on the city council, which she has held since 2019. She was also a supporter of John Gomes, who mounted a primary challenge against Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim. The complaint, which was filed by one of Pereira's Democratic opponents, Kevin Monks, included numerous letters that were signed by voters in the Palisade Apartments, a low-income housing complex that was heavily targeted by campaigns in the 2023 primary. Pereira, who helped to at least 179 people to sign up to vote absentee during the 2023 election, said Monks filed the complaint against her because he ran against me and lost. She added that Monks is just another Ganim operative. I'm not worried about it in the least, Pereira said. This is not a sprint, but a marathon, and I'm preparing a massive lawsuit against the city. Monks' complaint points out that Pereira lost the in-person vote in her district, which covers the northeast corner of the city, but ended up winning the election based on the strength of her absentee votes. Both during the primary and afterwards, we heard from many residents who complained that Pereira had engaged in illegal and unethical behavior both during the election and past elections. Monks wrote in the complaint, Monks did not respond to a phone call Wednesday, neither did Gomes, who eventually lost to Ganim in a redo election in early 2024. Many of the letters that were submitted as part of the complaint allege Pereira harvested people's ballots ahead of the election, which is illegal in Connecticut unless you are a family member or designee for those voters. Maria Pereira came to my home and took the ballot, the letter from Roosevelt James said. She indicated that she would mail it for me. She told me what line to vote for, and I signed it. Some of the letters also allege that Pereira had been collecting absentee ballots in the lead-up to municipal elections for years. I would like you to know that for 4 years, Maria Pereira has taken my voting ballot and stuffed it in her bag to drop it off, one letter from Roxanne LaFountain said. Maria likes to bribe the seniors, bringing them Christmas presents, buying them food, getting them little things. The complaint also accused Pereira, in several cases, of tricking elderly voters into canceling completed absentee ballots that had already been returned to city election officials. The Connecticut Mirror published an investigation last year that showed how Pereira and others helped voters to fill out a rarely used form in order to invalidate the votes that had already been cast and to obtain a replacement absentee ballot. Those forms, which were printed on green paper, are meant to be used by voters to replace an absentee ballot that has been damaged or lost, or in cases where voters made an innocent mistake on their ballot. One of the forms Pereira helped voters to fill out, it was alleged the new ballots were needed because her opponents and other supporters of Ganim's campaign had illegally taken the voters' initial absentee ballots. Continuing in Sunday CT, former pasta factory gets new life in South Windsor. New owners plan to create more than 200 jobs. The enormous South Windsor food processing plant that used to house Carla's Pasta is being renovated for a new tenant that plans to produce fully cooked and frozen meals, ranging from meatballs to battered chicken for frozen dinners. Before it opens next June, Home Market Foods' new facility will begin hiring a workforce that the company predicts will number more than 200 before 2028. Massachusetts-based Home Market Foods produces food for cafeterias, convenience stores, club stores, supermarkets, and more. Its Cooked Perfect line of frozen meatballs is sold at Stop and Shops, ShopRite's, Price Choppers, Market 32's, and Big Y's across central Connecticut. The company has its headquarters in a 185,000-square-foot plant and office building in Norwood, Massachusetts, and will boost its production space sharply when the 153,000-square-foot South Windsor plant starts operations. Home Market Foods announced last week that it will put more than $70 million in renovations and tooling, and by 2028 anticipates employing 210 people there. The company says the acquisition is part of a strategy for expansion. 7 years ago, it took over Chicago's Kelly Eisenberg brand of hot dogs and corned beef and says it is looking for further growth in its field of prepared meat-based meals and snacks, entrees and handheld items, frozen or refrigerated snacking items, ethnic foods, and refrigerated deli items. Home Market Foods website says Eisenberg's hot dogs are sold through Chicago area Home Depots, and Walmart advertises some of the company's Roller Bites appetizers. Home Market Foods also sells the Bahama Mama line of sausages. Carla's was a significant South Windsor employer, producing a variety of pastas along with appetizers, pestos, and sauces for national retailers and food service businesses. Its menu at one point included breaded cheese and breaded meat ravioli, tortellini alfredo, stromboli bites, buffalo chicken bites, and more. The family-run business advertised at its height that it was producing nearly 1 million pounds of pasta a month, and it substantially expanded its South Windsor plant in 2018. But its owners blamed the pandemic for a devastating downturn in business 2 years later, and it declared bankruptcy in early 2021. Much of its equipment was sold at auction, and Wisconsin-based Tribe 9 Foods bought the Carla's brand and still markets it. The town and state are providing tax incentives for Home Market Foods to bring the plant back to operation. There is no shortage of location options for companies like Home Market Foods to consider, so I'm delighted that they chose Connecticut and chose to bring their business to our state, Governor Ned Lamont said in a prepared statement. Lamont said a team, including the State Economic Development Department, Eversource, Advanced CT, local officials, including Mayor Audrey Dolnecki, and Metro Hartford Alliance helped present Connecticut's case as the company considered where it would establish an additional plant. The town has been eager to get the property productive again. In May, town manager Michael Maniscalco told the town council that the outlook appeared good for Home Market Foods to go forward. He said the company was seeking a state employment tax credit. Everything I've heard has been very, very positive so far. I believe they have conditional employment offers in place for some of the employees, he said. Every sign I can see is very positive. A win-win on the water. Experts say baffling beavers can help protect both wildlife and land. This is by Maureen Murphy, who is special to the Current. There's a non-lethal way to handle most nuisance wildlife, according to Diane Honer, a former wildlife rehabilitator and owner of Beaver Wildlife Solutions. The more life we kill, the more we are killing ourselves, she contends. Honer is an opponent of the use of lake hold traps, which can be indiscriminate and catch the wrong animal, including companion pets, and as a wildlife rehabilitator, she said she has seen firsthand the agonizing damage it is done by those types of traps. Dislocated joints, limbs chewed off to escape, and necrotic open wounds are common, she said. As a result of her experiences with badly injured wildlife, she became a licensed wildlife control operator and is now operating out of Chester. She works to protect beavers and also champions the extensive work being done by the Beaver Institute, created by Mike Callahan. Callahan, whose wife is a nuisance wildlife control operator as well, decided in 2017 to do something about the ongoing problem of nuisance wildlife, such as beavers, with the goal of providing an alternative to trapping. With the support of others, he created the Beaver Institute. The Institute website notes the complicated nature of the issue. While beavers build dams that create biodiversity and have many other benefits, sometimes these dams can cause serious flooding problems for people. When this happens, the beavers are all too often killed and their dams removed. To address the issue here, the Beaver Institute created the Connecticut Beaver Initiative, a program intended to help the state of Connecticut help property owners and municipalities resolve human-beaver conflicts non-lethally. The John T. and Jane A. Wiederhold Foundation of Connecticut, associated with the Northwest Community Foundation, awarded the nonprofit institute a $25,000 $500 grant to support non-lethal beaver control efforts within the state. The Beaver Institute's goal is to help educate the public about alternatives to lake hold traps and encourage the use of non-lethal means of handling wildlife. In part, it includes use of what are called pond levelers, a drainage piping system that outsmarts the beavers and uses a beaver baffle cage to keep the animals from removing the pipes. Callahan said he has installed over 2,000 systems, largely in Massachusetts so far. They work through pipes to drain water level safely where beaver dams have caused flooding on farms, roads, basements, and in municipal locations. On average, taxpayers saved $180 each annually, he notes, and the beaver baffle and water leveling pipes last for several years, as opposed to having to set traps annually, thereby being more cost-effective overall. Callahan said that municipal officials in Massachusetts found that removing the beavers by trapping them, eating up their budget, and road crews were working many hours to clear culverts and clean out water grates on flooded roads. It's a win-win situation to use the water leveling devices, he said. The pipe systems lower the water level to prevent flooding, and the beavers are able to stay in their lodges. Callahan said he has a guaranteed track record of successful use of at a price tag that is lower than most nuisance control options. In 3 out of 4 situations, the beaver baffles work well, he said. Honer, who installs similar systems in Connecticut, said she has been able to find workaround methods so that no animals are killed. Honer said she also wants to see use of lake hold traps ended. Neighboring states of Massachusetts and Rhode Island have ended the use of lake hold traps through voter referendums. In April, an appeal was made by representatives from Harvard Law School's Animal Law and Policy Clinic to support changes to the regulatory process in Connecticut. According to Connecticut 2024 regulations, fur-bearing animals for which there is an open trapping season may be taken by box traps, live traps, deadfalls, padded and unpadded metal traps, smooth wire traps, and species-specific traps, subject to certain restrictions, including on placement and size of opening. The regulations show these as prohibited. Use of any type of snare, traps, placed, set, or tended within 10 feet of the waterline of a muskrat or beaver house, and traps with serrations or teeth. Handling wildlife issues humanely is not incompatible with human lifestyles, Honer said, who previously sought a ban on leghold traps and spoke with Connecticut legislators in November 2023. She submitted the design of an alternative flow device that can be inserted in beaver dams. The device prevents flooding and costs approximately $1,800 with a life of up to 10 years, she said. Stephen Weissensale, retired UConn professor, said animal control officers, Department of Energy and Environmental Protection officials, nuisance wildlife business owners, state park staff, and Connecticut residents are all part of the web that see damaging effects of the current leghold trapping system. Weissensale said he has extensive documentation regarding injuries to domestic pets, as well as foxes and other wildlife from such traps. Owls, red-tailed hawks, and other birds also are maimed for life or killed by leghold traps, the Harvard letter notes. Callahan noted that another troublesome issue is that traps are supposed to be checked daily by nuisance wildlife control operators in the event that the wrong animal is captured, but that does not always happen. Beaver ponds capture pollutants and purify water. They push it into the earth, which replenishes what is lost during drought, Honer said. The pond levelers, culvert fences, and fencing around trees are alternate means to drowning and mutilating wildlife and should be considered, she said. Weissensale's wife, Nan Weissensale, said there are plans underway to revisit the trap issue through the Connecticut legislative process. I don't accept that it has to be this way. You have to pursue it. We keep trying, she said. Turning now to the Insight section of the Sunday, July 7th, Hartford Current. Time for action. For effort to drive down prescription drug costs, clock is running out. This is by Nathan Tinker. He's the CEO of Connecticut Pharmacists Association. It's not every day in Washington that there's a bipartisan proposal on the table that, if moved forward, could drive down prescription drug costs and positively impact health care for nearly every American. But right now, legislation that fits that description is awaiting action in the Senate Health, Energy, Labor, and Pensions Committee, or HELP. What's the issue? The clock. Our federal lawmakers, including Senator Chris McCarthy, have just a few weeks to move Pharmacy Benefit Manager, or BPM, reform legislation out of the HELP committee before summer recess. Here in Connecticut, our lawmakers have passed legislation meant to protect pharmacists and their patients from the various methods that PBMs use to limit access to medications while padding their own bottom lines. But enforcement of these policies has been a challenge. In partnering with patient-provider groups, we were able to put into place important measures to ensure that every dollar that goes toward a patient's copays are applied to their deductible or maximum out-of-pocket costs, and that pharmacists have the ability to tell patients where they might save money by not processing their prescription through insurance. But as many laws as we've passed, the PBMs seem to find new ways to complicate the system for patients, to drive independent pharmacies out of business, and to ensure that they are making as much money as possible from virtually every aspect of the pharmaceutical supply chain. We have heard story after story about patients not being able to access their medications, and at the same time the frustration of pharmacists who can't help because they too often have their hands tied by PBMs. A recent investigation by the New York Times found that PBMs often direct patients to medications with higher out-of-pocket costs, overcharge government programs like Medicaid and Medicare, or harm pharmacies with outrageous fees and low reimbursement rates. We don't have to look far for evidence of any of these, but it is especially evident with the demise of local independent pharmacies. Since 2019, about 50% of Connecticut's independent pharmacies have closed. Sadly, this has been felt more widely in rural parts of our state, with Windham, Tolland, and Litchfield counties feeling the greatest impact. Due to the way insurance plans are regulated, both state and federal legislation is needed to truly protect Connecticut residents and all Americans. It is critical that we not let another year go by without federal action on PBMs. We call on Senator Murphy to work with his HELP committee colleagues to support regulation and transparency of the PBM industry. Next up from the Insight section, the best prospect to remind Americans of perils we face. This is Kevin Rennie's column. A reckless Supreme Court and an oblivious president cast a long shadow over Independence Day celebrations. The Supreme Court's decision on Monday expanded presidential immunity, removing the President of the United States from traditional restraints of the rule of law. The decision provided a bleak reminder that a majority of the High Court's 9 members did not tell the truth when they stated at their confirmation hearings that no one, including the president, is above the law. The court ruled in the prosecution of Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th insurrection intended to halt the orderly counting of Electoral College votes that certified Trump's defeat and Joe Biden's victory. The 6-3 majority could have issued a narrow ruling on the government's indictment of Trump. Instead, its confederacy of radicals dressed up as conservatives dismantled nearly every protection we have from an executive with authoritarian instincts. Repairing the damage the Roberts Court has inflicted on the nation will take years or even decades and may be preceded by unprecedented abuses. The decision came 4 days after Biden's calamitous debate performance. If a candidate for governor or Congress or the state legislator would have put on a public display of confusion lapsing into incoherence in a debate, party leaders would intervene before voters delivered a firm rebuke on Election Day. The Biden campaign's post-debate talking points were nonsensical. His defenders claimed after the cataclysm that it is hard to debate a liar spewing his trademark falsehoods. The opposite is true. A candidate who knows his brief and can form full sentences will refute his opponent's prevarications to great effect. No amount of renovating changes what we saw for 90 grim minutes. Biden has lived at the highest level of national politics for more than 50 years. This is his 5th campaign for national office. The Delaware Democrat knows how to prepare for a debate. If Biden is not the addle-pated altar caker he appeared to be in Atlanta, he would have told his team of debate coaches he needed to concentrate on themes, not figures. Those debate pros would have helped Biden if they had reminded him of the difference between COVID and Medicare. One of the many gobsmacking moments of the night came when Biden said he would make sure that we're all able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the COVID. Excuse me, with dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare. Biden might have delivered his answers in Esperanto for all the sense they made. On abortion, Biden said, there's a lot of young women are being raped by their in-laws, by their spouses, brothers and sisters, by, it's just ridiculous, and they can do nothing about it. The president's meanderings were more incomprehensible than ridiculous and frightening. His explanation of Roe v. Wade would have earned him a failing grade on any law school exam. Dr. Footlights usually improves a candidate on the night. So does a week of sleep and preparation. What we saw was Biden likely as good as he can be in a sustained, unrehearsed event, lost without a teleprompter. In a nation that disagrees about many urgent issues, Biden has united us on one. 80% of voters agree that he is too old for another 4 years as president. He is an old 81. As the comic icon Jackie Moms Mabley said of one of her fictional husbands, he is old. Older than his age. So old he looks like Santa Claus is his son. Every partisan tool who asks us to ignore what we witnessed inflicts damage on our nation and the aspirations of free people around the world. Biden's greatest failure was his inability to refute Trump. The loathsome demagogue made it clear once more that he despises America. We are not a failing nation. We are not a third world country. The felon slanders the United States and the people who live in it at every opportunity, and Biden extracts no price. As Biden flailed, Trump defamed Vladimir Zelensky, the great man of our time, and Biden did nothing. Last weekend, the New York Times added to our collective fear with the news that Biden relies on his son Hunter for advice on the way forward. That is the same Hunter Biden who, his recent trial confirmed, lured his girlfriend and his brother's widow, that's one person, into using crack. Whether or not Hunter Biden is in recovery, he possesses depraved instincts and should be far from decisions that will determine the results of this election. Vice President Kamala Harris will meet the moment. She and her best prospect for a running mate, Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, will do what Biden cannot: take the fight to Trump and remind Americans of the peril he embraces. Kevin Rennie can be reached at kfrennie@yahoo.com. And moving on in the Insight section, I have an opinion piece by Robert Reich, who is a former U.S. Secretary of Labor. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It. You can read more from Robert Reich at https://robertreich.substack.com. I want to reassure you about this country. I know that you're worried and upset. You have every reason to be. Donald Trump is a vile human being, and he got away with a tsunami of lies Thursday night. Joe Biden didn't come across with the vitality he needed to show. I have no idea whether Biden will get his mojo back or the Democrats will find someone else to take on Trump, but I have an abiding faith in the common sense and good-heartedness of most Americans. Although we're horribly divided right now, the fact is, again and again, we've rejected vicious haters and demagogues, Father Coughlin, Joe McCarthy, George Wallace, to name a few. We've made a few bad mistakes in our choices of president, to be sure, but we've corrected them as soon as we could. We elected James Buchanan in 1856, but he was out in 4 years. We allowed Andrew Johnson to become president following Lincoln's assassination, but we impeached him. We elected Richard Nixon in 1968, but sent him packing in 1974. We elected Trump in 2016, although more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton, and we didn't re-elect him in 2022. There have been times when I doubted America. I think the worst was 1968 with the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and then Bobby Kennedy, the riots and fires that consumed our cities, the horrific Democratic convention in Chicago, along with protests and violent police response, the election of the dreadful Nixon, and the escalating carnage in Vietnam. It seems to me then that we had utterly lost our moral compass and purpose. But the Watergate hearings demonstrated to me that we had not lost it. Democrats and Republicans worked together to discover what Nixon had done. I had much the same feeling about the brilliant work done by the House's Special Committee to investigate January 6, 2021. Washington, D.C. is not the Gomorrah portrayed in the media, and I think it important not to become so consumed with its failings or its Republican crazies that we overlook the many good things happening there, particularly under Biden. The most aggressive use of antitrust and the most pro-union labor board I remember, and Biden's extraordinary legislative accomplishments. When I think about what's good about America, I also think about the jurors and prosecutors and the judge in Trump's recent trial in Manhattan, who took extraordinary abuse. Their lives and the lives of their families were threatened, but they didn't flinch. They did their duty. I think about our armed services men and women. I think about our firefighters and police officers. I think about our teachers and social workers and our nurses who acted with such courage and dedication during the pandemic. I think about all the other people who are putting in countless hours in our cities and towns and states to make our lives better. And all the people who are working their hearts out right now to make sure Donald Trump stays out of the White House. I assure you I am doing the same, and I hope you are as well. A few nights ago, I had dinner with an old friend whom I haven't seen in many years. He's now a United States Senator. He works extraordinarily hard. He cares deeply about the country. He shares many of our values. He told me that he seriously doubts Americans will elect Donald Trump. I agree with him. We are so much better than Trump. Next up, we have an opinion by Lisa Jarvis from Bloomberg Opinion. HIV shot can't get to high-risk groups fast enough. Revolutionary. A game changer. Spine-chilling. Those are some of the words experts use to describe fresh data for lenacapavir, a twice-yearly shot developed by Gilead Sciences for the prevention of HIV. Their enthusiasm stems from a more succinct word, zero. That's the number of cases of HIV that developed in the women and adolescent girls who received the drug in a huge study conducted across dozens of sites in South Africa and Uganda. Lenacapavir has the potential to at long last move the needle in the incidence of HIV. The virus caused some 1.3 million infections and 630,000 deaths in 2022. One expert told me this drug, if given to enough at-risk women, could be the way to get close to eliminating pediatric HIV. Another talked about bending infection curves in young women and adolescent girls, who account for 77% of new infections among younger people in sub-Saharan Africa. But none of that will happen without the right pieces in place to get the drug to everyone who needs it as soon as it receives regulatory clearance. That's an all-hands-on-deck effort that should be underway now. Lenacapavir's advantage is its unique mechanism of and months-long activity. While other HIV antivirals target enzymes the virus needs to replicate, lenacapavir takes aim at the capsid, an eggplant-shaped shell made up of hundreds of proteins that assemble to protect the virus's genetic material. As it turns out, disrupting that shell works as a prophylaxis. In the trial, there are no HIV infections in the more than 2,100 women who received the drug, compared with infection rates of 1.5% and 1.8% in women taking Truvada and Descovy, two types of daily pills to prevent HIV infection, also known as PrEP. I've been doing this for almost 40 years. I have never, ever seen a result like this before, said Salim Abdul Karim, an infectious disease epidemiologist and director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa. To see a 100% efficacious product, it just blew my mind. Capriza enrolled several hundred women in the study through Abdul Karim, though Abdul Karim was not directly involved. A separate prevention study of lenacapavir in men who have sex with women and transgender people is underway, after which Gilead plans to ask for regulatory approval. The drug is on the market in the U.S. and elsewhere for the treatment for HIV. But the data involving young women are already extraordinary. The existing options for PrEP, whether daily pills, the dapivirine vaginal ring, or Vivi's bimonthly shot cabotegravir, have not moved the needle much on rates of infection among young women. A daily intervention needs a daily decision. I'm going to protect myself, says Linda Gail Becker, director of Desmond Tutu HIV Center at the University of Cape Town, an investigator in the trial. A wildly effective twice-annual shot could make a huge difference in bending infection curves, particularly among women and infants. Yet this astounding success can only come to fruition if lenacapavir reaches the people who need it. That comes down to access and delivery. Lenacapavir needs to be made at a volume that it can be widely available, at a price that makes it widely accessible, and distributed in a way that makes it easy and appealing for everyone to stick with. The ball is in Gilead's court on the issues of price and supply, and Gilead is, so far, saying all the right things. The same day it revealed the trial results, the biotech company announced a two-pronged approach to ensuring lenacapavir can be widely available in the places being hit hardest by HIV. It will form license agreements that allow generic firms to make and sell the drug in low-resource countries hard hit by the HIV epidemic, a strategy used successfully in the past. And until that generic supply is up and running, the company says it will set aside supply for those regions. That elicited cautious optimism. But Gilead will also need to commit to transparency at every step of the process. While the company has made substantial efforts to ensure people in low- and middle-income countries can access its HIV therapies, it also has been criticized for some of its tactics around the price and developments of certain medicines. Global health experts would like to better understand which countries will have access to low-cost generic versions of the drug, and be assured that the company will work to transfer not only patents, but know-how to ensure the speedy increase in manufacturing. That third piece of the equation, delivery, will require a huge effort by global health agencies and their partners to study the most effective way to get the treatment to at-risk groups, not just once, of course, but every 6 months during the years they might be vulnerable to infection. The work these groups have already done to provide existing forms of PrEP provide a good foundation for distributing lenacapavir, says Carmen Perez-Casas, Senior Strategy Lead at UnitAid. Meanwhile, studies will need to be quickly designed and funded to understand the best ways to ensure broad and consistent use of the biannual shot. This new drug, while astounding, does not obviate the need to keep pushing for an effective HIV vaccine. Yes, the new drug will likely meaningfully reduce infections, which also reduces transmission, but a vaccine that ideally can be administered before puberty is the key to eradicating this deadly virus. Turning now to the arts and living section. Start with a story on a musical by Christopher Arnault, an up-close production of campy musical The Prom. When it appeared on Broadway in 2018, the musical The Prom was praised for its deft combination of old-school musical theater style with a contemporary tale of a lesbian teen who is castigated by the small town she lives in for daring to want to attend her high school prom. Playhouse on Park is chosen the joyous, consciousness-raising musical comedy as its summer musical this year, running July 10th through August 18th. On Broadway, The Prom was a classic proscenium stage musical with deliberately tacky high school prom sets and grand classic Broadway-friendly performances. The musical was made into a similarly flashy movie starring James Corden, Meryl Streep, and Ariana DeBose in 2020. The show has profound messages about community, family acceptance, and understanding, but it's also a wild comedy anchored by outrageous stereotypes of self-absorbed Broadway stars, oblivious high school principals, and domineering parents. Robert Mintz, who is directing and choreographing The Prom for Playhouse on Park, knows that bringing such unrestrained Broadway oomph would be wrong for the room. The Playhouse on Park performance area is floor level and surrounded on three sides by the audience, with the front rows just a few feet from the edge of the stage. Mintz envisions a production that seeks to make stronger human connections. I'm slightly daunted because it is a big old-fashioned musical, but I'm excited to do it in this intimate space. The Prom, Mintz said, seems like a classic musical comedy fluff, but with real emotion. His up-close production will reflect that. In losing some of the presentation staginess of the show, Mintz has also upped its modern themes. This production features an ensemble of local LGBTQ youth playing many of the high school students in the school. Two separate teen ensembles will alternate performances throughout the show's month-long run. "It's impressive the honesty they bring to it," Mintz said of the young cast members. Mintz sees this production as connecting to three distinct audiences. Older fans of musical theater will respond to the musical's traditional theater styles and its crazy caricatures. A younger crowd will relate to the 20-something actors playing the main teen characters, and a still younger demographic will relate to the contemporary LGBTQ+ chorus. "While we're spanning generations with this," the director-choreographer said. He notes that, as well as the LGBTQ ensemble, some of the adult actors and the younger leads are also queer. One of the creative forces behind The Prom, book writer Bob Martin, also wrote the book for another old-fashioned contemporary musical, the 2006 Broadway hit The Drowsy Chaperone. Martin's current project is a highly anticipated Betty Boop musical set to open on Broadway next year. Chad Begwellen, who contributed to the book and also wrote the lyrics for The Prom, is known for the highly theatrical stage version of Disney's Aladdin. Composer Matthew Sklar worked with Begwellen on the musical versions of Elf and The Wedding Singer. Mintz, who said he was a big fan of the original Broadway production of The Prom, moved to Hartford recently when his husband enrolled in the law program at the University of Connecticut. Mintz left a thriving career as an actor and director in the Washington, D.C., Maryland, Delaware theater scenes when he arrived in Connecticut. "I reached out to local theaters and Playhouse at Park welcomed me in with open arms." Mintz co-choreographed the wartime jazz musical Bandstand at the Playhouse last year and directed the touring youth theater production of Polka Dots, the Cool Kids musical, this past spring. He's on board to choreograph Singin' in the Rain at the Playhouse on Park next season. He's also looking to get involved with other Connecticut theaters. Playhouse on Park has brought scenes from its The Prom to West Hartford Pride Festival and the Hartford Health Collective's 30th annual Queer Prom event. "I'm impressed by their outreach," Mintz said. The Hartford Health Collective connection led to a creative charitable event happening during the run of The Prom. It's a formal prom attire donation and collection drive where the theater's patrons are encouraged to donate new or like new gowns, fancy dresses, suits, tuxedos, shirts, ties, accessories, and shoes. The items can be dropped off at the Playhouse during regular box office hours, Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., or when attending a performance of The Prom. The prom clothes will be given to those attending future queer proms at the Health Collective. Similar outfits will be on view on stage at Playhouse on Park. It's transferred into a party-happy high school. "It's going to feel like a prom," Mintz said. As a gay man myself, I wasn't out in high school, he said. The show is a lovely opportunity to revisit with open eyes what could have been, and for younger generations, what can be. And next, art picks for July 8th to 14th by Christopher Arnault. Get up close with Counting Crows, Elvis Costello, and Boys Like Girls. There's a bit of a lull in the summer concert schedule this week, at least at the arena and amphitheater level. Happily, the casinos, music halls, and small clubs are picking up the slack with exciting acts like Cumbia Queers, originally from Argentina, Jewel House from Denver, Colorado, and Bad Cop a Bad Cop from San Pedro, California, playing on local stages. At larger venues, you'll find Boys Like Girls, Counting Crows, and the intriguing double bill of Elvis Costello and Daryl Hall. This week also marks the start of this year's Paul Brown Monday Night Jazz Series in Bushnell Park, a blast of free outdoor jazz on a night when live shows can be hard to find. Here are some of the top things to see this week in Connecticut. Billy Harper Quintet, Bushnell Park, 1 Jewel Street, Hartford. Tenor sax titan Billy Harper came up playing with the likes of Max Roach, Thad Jones, Art Blakey, and the Jazz Messengers, among other legends, and has been leading his own quintet since the mid-60s. Harper is kicking off the 2024 Paul Brown Monday Night Jazz Series, a free summer concert tradition in Bushnell Park for 57 years. July 8th in Bushnell Park at 7:30 p.m. with opening act Steve Ballmer's Hall Monitors Quintet, made up of jazz coaches from Hall High School in West Hartford. Going on at 6 p.m., the rain location is Asylum Hill Congregational Church at 814 Asylum Avenue. Go to hartfordjazzsociety.com for more information. Untitled Andrew Callahan Film Screening and Q&A. This is at District Music Hall, 71 Wall Street in Norwalk. Journalist and YouTube personality Andrew Callahan unveils a years-in-the-making R-rated secret documentary. The film will be shown, and Callahan will take part in a Q&A on July 9th at 7 p.m. at Norwalk's District Music Hall. No phones, cameras, or recording devices will be allowed in the auditorium. Tickets are $39 to $69. Go to districtmusichall.com for more information. The Greater Hartford Shakespeare Festival, University of St. John, 1678 Asylum Avenue, West Hartford. This year, the Greater Hartford Shakespeare Festival is doing two Shakespeare shows, not just one. They've also added microphones for the actors. It's all because the festival drew record crowds in the last couple of summers. The shows and special pre-show talks and concerts happen July 10th through August 4th on the lawn outside the University of St. Joseph. Performances of The Taming of the Shrew are July 10th, 13th, 18th, 19th, 21st, 24th, and 27th, and August 1st, 2nd, and 4th. Performances of Hamlet are July 11th, 12th, 14th, 17th, 20th, 25th, 26th, 28th, and 31st, and August 3rd. In case of rain, the shows move inside to the USJ's Otorino Center. Tickets are $25 or free for youth under 11 years, with discounts for seniors, students, military, groups, and those who have tickets to both plays. Go to capitalclassics.org. Bad Cop, Bad Cop at the Space Ballroom, 295 Treadwell Street, Hamden. The female California punk band Bad Cop, Bad Cop hasn't been able to visit Connecticut very often. They were in Hartford for the 2017 Warped Tour and have otherwise found a Connecticut home at the Space Ballroom in Hamden, where they've played three times, but not since 2021. Bad Cop, Bad Cop is back for a fourth go-round on July 12th at 8 p.m., with opening acts Oceanator and Arms Like Roses. $25, $20 in advance. Go to spaceballroom.com for more information on that. Elvis Costello and Daryl Hall at Mohegan Sun Arena, 1 Mohegan Sun Boulevard, Uncasville. Based on coverage of shows earlier in this tour, Elvis Costello and Daryl Hall don't actually do any songs together, unlike some other Costello tours. But they have a pile of fine songs to plow through. There's another great name involved, creative guitarist Charlie Sexton, who's part of Costello's band, The Imposters, on this tour. July 12th at 7 p.m., tickets are $59.95 to $359. Go to MoheganSun.com for more information. Boys Like Girls, Foxwoods Resort Casino, 350 Trolley Line Boulevard, Mashantucket. Boys Like Girls, the hard-charging alt-rock emo band from Andover, Massachusetts, named its latest album Sunday at Foxwoods, and guess where and when they're playing this week. At Foxwoods Premier Theater on July 12th at 7 p.m., tickets are $61.65 to $119.20. Go to foxwoods.com. Cumbia Queers at Cafe 9, 250 State Street, New Haven. Cumbia Queers, the all-female punk band with the Colombian folk dance beats, will raise a righteous ruckus on the small Cafe 9 stage on July 12th at 9 p.m. $25, $20 in advance. Go to cafe9.com for more info. Jewel House, Roadrunner Kitchen and Bar, 2931 Fairfield Avenue, Bridgeport, Arch Street Tavern, 85 Arch Street, Hartford. It's not often that a live disco pop band from Colorado comes to town. The Denver-based eclectic groove project Jewel House has two shows in Connecticut this week. July 12th at Roadrunner Kitchen and Bar in the Black Rock section of Bridgeport. Go to roadrunnerct.com. And July 13th at Arch Street Tavern in Hartford, $10 at garchstreettavern.com for more information. And that is street spelled out, ARCHSTREETTAVERN.com for more information. And finally, Counting Crows, Mohegan Sun Arena, 1 Mohegan Sun Boulevard in Uncasville. Say what you want about Counting Crows, but the band